I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. We are broadcasting live today from St. John's College. It's our 7th annual Annapolis Summit. Our partners in all this is our Baltimore Business Journal and the Mark Steiner Show, of course, WEAA 88.9 FM in Baltimore, Maryland. Our sponsors are Constellation Energy, Safe and Sound Campaign, Maryland State Education Association, Veolia Transportation, the ACLU of Maryland, and, of course, our other media partner is Delmarva Public Radio, WSCL, WSDL. We're broadcasting these programs live, later on this evening, and be streamed on the various websites. We're about to begin our second hour. We're joined here in the auditorium at St. John's College by the President of the Maryland Senate, Mike Miller, and the Speaker of the House, Mike Bush. Gentlemen, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you. Good to be here. Thank you.
And we do have microphones to our right and left, and we do want our audience to participate and ask all the questions you'd like of our two top legislative leaders. Well, Mike Miller, you are, as we were talking to the governor about this, you're what we might call the resident historian.
Right.
Of
That's sad.
When was the last time you recall facing a session as tough as this in terms of the cuts we face and the revenue shortages we face?
There really hasn't been anything like this in my lifetime. And this is the greatest recession, obviously, since the recession. We had a very difficult recession in 1990 and 1991. And those were days when we had leaders like Jack Cade here in Anne Arundel County, moderate Republican, and Howie Dennis in Montgomery County. And with their tough votes, we were able to get through the recessionary period. We raised the income tax and cast a lot of tough votes, raised the gas tax. Last time it's been raised since 1992. Cut a lot of items from the budget, but we came together, Republicans and Democrats, and we solved the problem. We hope to do that again this time. It's going to be much difficult because the parties are farther apart. There's not a lot of give and take. And we have a strong leader, Governor Martin O'Malley. He's going to be cutting the budget by $1 billion. But we haven't seen as of this date. So we're going to look forward to see what he has put forth on the table. And then we've got to come back and cut another $1 billion from the budget. So it's going to be very difficult times. So I would say since the last Depression, this is the toughest time that Marylanders have experienced.
People in both houses I've talked to, and some last night just by happenstance meeting him in the hotel or right. Walking the streets last night, I came up with a list of potential ways to raise revenue in the state of Maryland beyond where we are, and the response to a person was no, not this year. We're not going to enhance any revenues anywhere. It's not going to happen, which means you have to come up with cuts. Is that the case?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. First of all, I think that the infrastructure that we have, with the revenue base that we have during a normal economy, will cover the priorities that we want to fund, be it education or health care or transportation. So I think the revenue structure we have is a very good one. We're suffering through a recession that every other state is suffering through. This is not made by the state of Maryland. This is a national recession. So I think the vast majority of people feel that our structure is a good one. And we believe that if we don't have any increases, and we voted the spending affordability not to have any increase in the budget, which is the first time since I've been in the legislature in 24 years that's occurred, that we're going to be able to continue to fund our programs. I ask everybody to make a little bit of a sacrifice. I mean, state employees have been furloughed, legislators have taken furlough, so we can get through this tough recessionary period. And as consumer confidence improves, the unemployment rate goes back down. I think that'll happen in the next 12 to 18 months. I think Maryland will be in position to come out of the recession in better shape than most of the other states and go forward. So I think we're looking forward to making some tough decisions, but knowing that going forward, Maryland's going to be able to fund its priorities.
Now, that's not a good football catch. You're looking forward to making tough decisions, but how can you, I mean, these decisions are going to be very rough. I mean, where are the cuts going to come from? We've seen in the past Medicaid get cut pretty severely. We've seen other things. Everything's on the board. We heard Martin O'Malley say earlier that he thought that college tuitions were going to have to be raised to some point. I mean, tell me about where you think the cuts will come from.
Well, you say Medicaid's getting cut, but Medicaid is like 30 to 40% of our deficit. This $2 billion deficit as the spiraling costs of Medicaid, and so that other areas have to be cut. And, you know, we're certainly not timid about doing what's responsible in terms of raising revenues. Both of us have voted for tax increases just as little as 2 years ago. We increased the sales tax by 1%, raised the income tax on very wealthy people in the state. And so we're not Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm when it comes to raising revenues. But at the same time, there comes a time when you've raised the revenues, you've made the cuts, you've made the investments, and now is not the time when we're looking for jobs, and more jobs to raise taxes.
Let me just say this. I think, you know, in the interim when we left, the governor, comptroller, and treasurer made about $700 million worth of cuts. Those cuts will continue into this fiscal year, which will take $700 million basically off of that deficit to start with. Then we will take the vast majority of funds that are in special accounts, use that in the general fund, and bond the money for those projects, be it open space, be it waterway improvement.
Can you take that money and put it into the general fund out of those special?
Yeah, and then bond those projects in the capital budget. Will be part of the things that we'll try to do as we go forward. And I think that, you know, as long as the Medicaid funding comes through from the federal government, which is the increased Medicaid as part of the stimulus money, I think we'll be able to get through this budget with a balanced budget. Obviously, furloughs will have to take place again, I mean, unfortunately for state employees, but as I say, also 80% of the legislature has also taken that. So we're going to find a way to get through this. Retain our AAA bond rating, and we still have $650 million in our rainy day fund. So we're in pretty good shape compared to the rest of the country.
So do you think in retrospect it was a mistake for Maryland not to, or was it right for Maryland not to raise the sales tax, expand the sales tax across the board to increase revenues for the state of Maryland? In retrospect, was that a mistake, or is that something that you think was a good thing that we did?
It was a very bold and noble thing to do, and the right thing to do at the time. It's unfortunately, the sales tax is regressive because both rich and poor pay the same amount of money, but Maryland is the 10th of the least state in terms of the sales tax revenues. You know, in Virginia, they apply it to food and, you know, clothing items and drug items. There are so many items that, you know, that we don't include, including dry cleaning and services such as that. It's very limited in the way we use it. It did generate $500 or $600 million, but we took half of that cent and used it for transportation to try to get people moving around the state and keep people working on the highways in terms of paving and project repairs.
Yeah, look, I think it was fair in this respect too. I mean, all the surrounding states are at 6 cents. I mean, Philadelphia has, you know, in Pennsylvania, 6 cents. Philadelphia has an extra penny. They can go on. Pittsburgh has an extra penny. 7 cents in New Jersey. You know, you have gross receipts tax in Delaware, so you really can't count that. And as the President of the Senate says in Virginia, I mean, they have a combination of a state sales tax, local sales tax, plus they tax food in supermarkets. We don't do that here in the state of Maryland. And you have to remember when, since 1992, we've given a credit for those earning under $100,000. So you get an exemption of $3,200 for every individual in your family. So if you're a family of four, you're getting about $14,000 in exemption a year that you aren't taxed on at all. So as we've asked some of the wealthier people to pay a little bit more, we've relieved some taxes on those making less than $100,000
in the family before. So, before I talk about this millionaire tax that we have, what the popular term for it? I mean, last year we had the battle over expanding the sales tax, and then ended up being the computer industry that fought back very hard, and that was pushed off the table.
Right.
So, because they became the only industry really that was where it was going to be expanded to, a lot of people would argue then that if we were going to expand the sales tax, what we should have done is expanded across the board, from plumbing to lawyers, to raise revenue that we needed. I mean, so it was that a good idea not to have done that? Was it just politically totally unfeasible to do that? Is it necessary to raise revenues, or are those things completely off the table forever?
They're not completely off the table forever, but it's expanding to services. It's where the job growth is, and so if you're going to raise revenues, obviously that would be a place to go, but there was certainly no appetite for it at the time. We, you know, we it was a compromise. It was slots. A lot of people didn't want to make that vote. I mean, the people who voted for the slots with Governor Ehrlich, all of a sudden, because he was a Democrat in the state house, said we can't vote for slots anymore. So the governor had to go to Democrats who had previously opposed it and said, look, we need your vote. And there were a lot of compromises made. We made the slots subject to local zoning control, made them subject to referendum, things that a lot of us didn't agree with, but it was part of a compromise. So those people agreed to slots, others agreed to taxes, and others agreed to cuts. It was really democracy in action, the compromises that this governor was able to fashion together to get us through that budgetary process.
So is the millionaire, what we call the millionaire's tax, a surcharge on the wealthiest part of our population, does that end this year? Is there a debate to continue it or not?
It continues through this fiscal year.
Right. But it ends in July, or June, I should say, right?
Well, this fiscal year, so it carries on through the fiscal year starting in July.
So is there a debate on continuing that and growing it, or ending it?
When we passed it, I mean, this was a compromise in 1991. And again, government is a lot about compromises. And we'd ended this session with no agreement on the budget. It was the House and the Senate were at loggerheads. William Donald Schaefer was the governor. And what he did, I had Republicans in the room, Democrats in the room, and William Donald Schaefer, he put down a legal pad and he said, look, what can we agree upon? The three of us, what can we agree upon? The House, the Senate, executive branch. And he would start writing down what we can agree upon and the areas of disagreement. And so finally, the final piece was Senator Cade and Senator Dennis, both who represented the wealthiest areas in the state. Senator Dennis represented Chevy Chase, the Republican. Senator Cade represented Severna Park as Republican. Both of them agreed to vote for an income tax on the wealthy people. But both of them said, look, we will do this as part of this compromise to move us forward, but it's got to end in 3 years when this recessionary period is over. And so this was sort of what we adopted this time. We said, look, it ended when the recessionary period was over. Let's put this in place, but it ends when the recessionary period is over. Unfortunately, the recessionary period is not over at this point in time.
So we are talking about Republicans and Democrats in a much more partisan situation than we were in a long time, I think, in politics, between Democrats and Republicans. I had Senator Kittleman and Senator Jacobs on my show the other night to talk about their perspective on where we're going. one of the things they said was that they felt that they are left out of the debate completely. Uh-huh. Especially in the House, and less so in the Senate, but even in the Senate, that they are not allowed to be full members of commissions and studies to talk about where we're going as a state, and that they are locked out from also the sources of the committees that have to do the research to talk about where the bill should go, and that they feel that they are completely dominated, even though they're a minority party, absolutely dominated by Democrats, giving no light to their points of view. And I think your name was called out larger on that than the president's.
Well, first of all, I find that odd because both Senator Kittleman and Senator Jacobs are in the Senate and don't participate in the House. So,
well, they were talking for their House brethren.
It's hard for me to understand how they can understand what takes place in the House when they're both in the Senate, but they must be clairvoyant.
It's just across the hall, isn't it?
it's an interesting observation that they might have. But let me just say this. I mean, Senator Miller and I had a work group, this interim that we put together to take a look at the relationship between local government and state government. And on that work group were both the minority leader of the House, minority leader of the Senate. Any conference committee we have on the budget, on the capital budget, if in fact you vote for the capital budget or the budget, we put a member of the minority party on that conference committee. In the House was Steve Shue this year on the operating budget, and Susan Allman, a Republican from Baltimore County, on the Conference Committee for the Capital Budget. So on every conference committee that takes place that individuals vote for the bill, we will put a member of the minority party in effect. Those who believe they do not participate in the process, in many respects, don't want to participate. I can point to people like George Edwards, who's been a career in the House, now in the Senate, participates greatly and makes himself a member of the committee. He's Don Munson in the Senate, has done the same thing. We have people in the House like Rick Weldon, who worked very well with the majority party, got so frustrated with the minority party that he became an independent. So the idea that somehow they don't participate really falls down upon them. I mean, a good carpenter doesn't blame his tools.
Well, they're not here to defend themselves. I just want to raise the issue for them. You want to add to that at all?
Yeah, sure. It's a little different in the Senate because members are more experienced. Generally, they've come over from the House. All the vinegar and fire is gone from them when they get to the Senate. I cleaned it up a little bit.
You did. That's good. This is radio.
We can't. I let people choose their own committees. See, I let them do their own area of expertise. We get along fairly well, and Senator Kittleman is a lawyer, and he specializes in workman's compensation cases, and he prefers to be on the Senate Finance Committee. Senator Jacobs is a fairly conservative legislator from Harford County, and she wants to crack down on these sexual predators, which I think is very good, and she wants to be on the Judicial Proceedings Committee, where the criminal laws are made, and so they're not on the budget committee. But if they wanted to be, as a leader, they would certainly be. The former Republican leader, Senator Stolfus, is on the budget committee. As the speaker indicated, Senator George Edwards is on the budget committee. Senator Munson's on the budget committee. The other former Republican leader, Senator Brinkley, is on the budget committee. And so these four people are at the table. You know, unlike other jurisdictions, we give them exact ratio of participation in the budget committee. They're in the decision, they offer amendments. A lot of their decision amendments pass. And so they're at the table, and we welcome their participation.
So somehow I feel that your management of the Senate is not quite as laissez-faire as you.
Well, if Alexander Hamilton says that the larger the body, the tighter the management. And it has to be that way, whether it's the House of Representatives, you know, or the House, the Speaker. I mean, I would cast votes in the when I was a member of the House of Delegates, and they said, "Why did you cast this vote?" And they said, "Look, the Speaker told me how to vote." You know, and now I got to the Senate, and I tell them how to vote, and they tell me to go to hell. You know what I mean? It's a little different on our side, believe me.
I'm Mark Steiner. We're broadcasting live today from St. John's College. Our partner with WEA's Mark Steiner Show is the Baltimore Business Journal. As we talk right now in the second hour to the President of the Senate, Mike Miller, and the Speaker of the House, Mike Bush. We can't take your calls. We do have people in the studio here. We're encouraging you all to join and come up to the mic whenever you'd like to join in this conversation and bring your issues to the floor here for the President and the Speaker. I keep getting to forget about the telephone number, but we can't take calls. We can't take your questions here live in the audience here at St. John's College, our 7th annual Annapolis Political Summit on the opening day of the political session. So in tougher issues, I'm curious where you think we can cut this budget anymore, what happens. I mean, it seems invariably when we cut budgets that the place it always gets cuts is on the back of the poorest people in the state. Whether we're talking about Medicaid or other issues that really affect the poorest segments of the state. So talk about where you think the debate and battle is going to be over where the cuts are. I know we haven't seen the governor's budget yet, but you've been around a long time. So where do you think the battles are going to be?
I think anything that's not a core government service.
What does that mean?
Well, I mean education, health care, public safety, research grants, stem cell research grants. Historical tax credits.
These are not part of the core budget you're talking about right now.
No, these are areas that are luxuries, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. They're worthy causes, and when times are good, this is the things that the government can indulge in. But at this time, when we're talking about jobs, when we're talking about government services, there are items in the budget that it's going to be hard to get back once we cut them. But when you're talking about our valued state employees and laying off valued state employees. The governor said fully fund program open space. I'm an environmentalist. I consider myself an environmentalist. I got the Patuxent River in one Sonoma district, the Chesapeake Bay on the other. But when you compare program open space and preserving, protecting lands versus laying off state employees, I opt to cut the program open space. So these are things that we're going to have to look at.
Let me first of all just, you know, people always talk about government as kind of this huge undertaking here. 40% of our budget is K through 12 education, goes right through the county governments. So right off the top, we send $5.5 billion to local county governments. If you add higher education, meaning the community colleges and the four-year universities and the private colleges, that's another $1.4 billion. That's better than 50% of your general fund budget goes directly into education. So you're going to cut that? Okay. The next is $3.2 billion to go to Medicaid. 80% of your Medicaid dollars go to senior citizens, developmentally disabled, mentally challenged individuals. You know, the vast majority of people in nursing homes, almost 80 to 90%, are on Medicaid. They spend down to get to Medicaid. They're your senior citizens. Developmentally disabled to get the waiver for autism and things of that nature. I mean, are you going to cut that? I mean, you know, I hear everyone saying, oh, we got to cut government. But you never can get any specifics out of the people like Senator Kittleman, who you mentioned, who wants to cut the budget, but he'll never give you the specifics of where he wants to cut it. You're not going to cut public safety. You're not going to cut corrections where those who guard the prisoners in the state penitentiaries. So where do you go?
Where do you go?
That's what I'm saying.
Where do you get this $2 billion? Where do we get it?
Well, I tell you where you're going to have to get it, and it'll be tough cuts. Is you're probably going to reduce reimbursement to provider groups, which means nursing homes and physicians to take care of Medicaid individuals. You're not going to cut the programs, but you're going to reduce reimbursement.
And hopefully superintendents of schools can come up with some ideas in terms of some reductions. You know, I know it's a very touchy subject, but there are public relations people in the school systems. There are, you know, assistant librarians, second vice principals, and things of that nature that we can deal with rather than affecting the classroom teacher. But we need to hear the superintendents of schools and let them tell us areas that they can cut back. As the speaker indicated, 40% of our budget goes to the counties, which goes right into public education.
We've already seen that. I said earlier today when I was talking to the governor that you see Harford County is talking about a 2% pay cut for their teachers. I mean, we've already seen that conversation starting in one county that could become a conversation from throughout the state. I'm still wanting to get back to where you two think this billion or $2 billion is going to come from that we have to find. What's our budget? $25 billion a year?
Our general fund budget is about $12.7 billion.
The entire budget, though.
The entire budget is about $30 billion. But that's mostly federal money that comes in for transportation, education, things of that nature.
So when we're talking about cutting $2 billion.
We're spending less money than we did 3 years ago. This is the first time in the history of the state this has occurred. Less money. We spent less money last year than the year before, even with the stimulus money. So each year we're spending less and less and less. We're spending less this year than when Martin O'Malley first took office. We are downsizing government incrementally.
Well, we just a moment ago talked about, you talked about, and you've talked about before, the idea when you want to cut government, where do you really cut? And how close to the bone do you cut government?
Right.
You just talked a minute ago about open space.
Right.
Now, we talked earlier with the governor about it. I mean, almost every scientist that's quoted or spoken to about the Chesapeake Bay right. say we're at best neutral, at worst we're losing the battle with the bay.
Right.
And that affects whether it's stormwater runoff, 40% coming from agriculture, continued highway and runoff from highways, and that we have now Senator Cardin introducing a bill to give the EPA much more leeway in saying what can be done or not be done in the state when it comes to the bay. And you're saying, you know, take the money away from the program open space because that's a luxury item. But when you talk about the future of the environment, at some point it's not going to be a luxury item. It's going to become a necessity if we're going to survive. So
we preserve more land than any state in the union. We have more agricultural land. Little Maryland, more agricultural land preserved than Texas or Oklahoma or Kansas or what have you. This has been a program of our governors. I mean, Governor Glenn Denning preserved more open space than all the governors in the history of the state of Maryland before him, combined. And so we're on a roll in this area. And I'm not saying cut it, but if it, in terms of options of state employees versus program open space, we can take a pass for a year or two on items such as this.
But let me explain this. And I think this is what the governor said and what I tried to say earlier. The money that comes into open space is going to go into the general fund. But those projects will go into the capital budget where they'll be bonded. So you will use bond money to pay for that land preservation at the same extent that it would come in for preservation through a special fund. So you're not going to stop buying the open space. Matter of fact, we'll probably get good deals on land because it should be under market value right now. And Senator Miller's right. We preserve more land than anyone else. Now, it's regrettable that the Bay has not improved, but it's not for lack of effort on the Maryland General Assembly, the Maryland Governor's point. You know, every time you have a major storm, everything comes down from the Susquehanna, from Pennsylvania. So everything that you've done as far as runoff and critical areas many times is dashed because you have this runoff that comes down from Pennsylvania where they have not taken the same precautionary steps to protect the Bay. And that's why you need a federal compact, which I think Governor Rendell, Governor O'Malley, and Governor Kane, and now the Governor of Virginia will try to work on to improve.
Do you agree with the Senator Cardin's bill and what he wants to do?
I spoke to the Anne County Farm Bureau the other night, and the farmers are very concerned. Because it involves non-navigable waters. For example, they've got a pond on their farm, and now the federal government's going to come in and tell the state how this pond has got to be dealt with. So they're very concerned. Big Brother coming in, they consider themselves the natural stewards of the land, and so the farmers would like the bill tweaked. There are also issues involving stormwater runoff that a lot of developers are concerned with. For example, there are projects that have got ponds, these holding ponds in place, but because of the recessionary period, they haven't been able to go forward with the projects. And this bill would require whole new regulations in terms of dealing with stormwater runoff, which doesn't involve these holding ponds. So there's going to have to be some compromises made along the way.
But the idea
behind the bill is fabulous, and the intent is great, but putting it in effect so that people can continue to not just do the business the way they've been doing it, but so that they're not put out of business is important.
So in the long run, I mean, it seems that we always seem to be arguing to one level or another, sacrificing the environment for our need for development.
Let me say this. I mean, the vast majority of zoning takes place at the local county levels. Under Governor Glenn Benning, we put in priority funding areas. We've tried every, I think, land use methodology at the state level to try to protect our Bay and our tributaries. In the General Assembly, under the leadership of Delegate McIntosh and Senator Conway, they've tightened the critical areas laws. They've put in septic regulations to limit nitrogen runoff into the Bay. They've done numerous things to try to limit any kind of runoffs going into the Bay. They worked with the farmers. They came up with cover crop legislation. So, I mean, it's not because of a lack of effort to try to control the sedimentation that goes into the Bay. I think everyone has tried to do that. Now, some of the local zoning restrictions are more lax than others and have a tougher effect on the Bay and its tributaries. But I would suggest to you also that there's no state that surrounds the Bay that has tougher restrictions to protect the Bay than the state of Maryland.
We're broadcasting live here from St. John's College. I'm Mark Steiner on WEA 88.9 FM. We are broadcasting here with our partners, the Baltimore Business Journal. And you'll hear this broadcast both on WEA, on DeMarva Public Radio. Our sponsors are Constellation Energy, Safe and Sound Campaign, Maryland State Education Association, Veolia Transportation, and ACLU of Maryland, a mixed bag if there ever was one of all sponsors, which is the way we like to have it. We thank our friends here at St. John's College, and our guests during the course of this hour are Senate President Mike Miller and Speaker of the House Mike Bush. We're going to turn this to the audience now and allow them to join this conversation. We will start, not in the political sense, but in fairness to our right.
Hi, I'm Nancy Ringgold, a former small-town newspaper publisher from Freeland, Maryland. And I have three questions, which I'll ask all at the same time. One has to do with agriculture, pedophilia, and slot machines. Why? My choice. When the governor was speaking, he mentioned that there was a Swedish company down on the Eastern Shore working with some of the chicken farmers.
I can't really hear you. Can you?
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
There we go.
There. The governor was mentioning a Swedish company which is developing something down on the Eastern Shore to do with the chicken farming. And I was wondering if there were bigger moves to change the manure from the chicken farms or the big place down, the recycling area down further down the bay, into energy on the site for renewable fuel. The second question has to do with pedophiles, and it'll probably make all the men in the audience slam their knees together. But for repeat offenders, has there ever been any bill introduced for neutering the repeat offenders? The third question about slot machines is, as I understand it, all the lotto, all the keno machines in all the taverns across the state are dually wired. So why is it not possible to have every tavern that has keno have three or four slot machines? Thank you.
Interesting questions.
Well, I don't oppose neutering, I can tell you that right now, for repeat sex offenders. And you know, I've got 13 grandchildren, and I think that would be treating extremely light. I'd want the neutering so that they couldn't do any more damage in prison while they're in prison for life. But the slot machines, I don't think it's good government. I've been a slot machine advocate only because it's a responsible thing to do, because we're trying to keep Maryland money home. We're battling Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Delaware in terms of Maryland cars going across the line. But we don't want them. Our idea was that we wanted them away from shopping centers. We wanted them away from families with kids. People would have to drive to racetracks where people were gambling anyway. And we certainly got away from that. But we just don't want them where it's immediately accessible to everybody. And in terms of agriculture, there is a move on foot to recycle the manure. The problem is finding someone that will buy the power. They've got the location, they've got the company that'll build it, but in terms of generating power that Delmarva Power will buy, or Constellation Power will buy, or the grid will take, that's the problem right now. We're moving forward in that. Also, we're recycling into pellets, taking the Purdue manure, recycling into pellets, and it's going out across the country, and that's taking place in Delaware right now.
The only thing I got, I think Senator Miller answered the question about agriculture pretty thoroughly there. I'm against neutering. Let me be upfront about that. I think we have a legal system and a criminal justice system in which we passed Jessica's law 2 years ago where you have mandatory sentences. The incident that took place on the Eastern Shore was one where someone was released through the justice system in Delaware. It was disposed on the predator list in Maryland and in Delaware. I think there has to be better communication between the states. I think we can tighten that up. Obviously, we don't want to see that take place. It was a horrendous accident. I'm a father of an 11-year-old daughter. It enraged me to see that take place. But I don't think neutering is the answer. Slot machines, we put slot machines in five different locations. Before we went to referendum, I asked every county executive and every delegation whether they want a slots facility in their county. And there were many people who wanted slots, no one wanted them in their county. So the slot facilities in the county is where they wanted to be. I asked Baltimore County to give us a location, they didn't want to give us one. I asked Harford County to give us a location, they didn't want to give us one. We wanted one in Talbot County, they didn't want one in Talbot County. So all these people that want slot machines, they want them everywhere else but in their own county.
Let's go to our left.
My name is Sharon Rubenstein, and I teach child advocacy at one of the state's great universities that the governor said earlier today will be experiencing a tuition increase. My question is about the alcohol tax. I've heard some estimates as high as $200 million for what could be generated at a 10-cent level. And even if it were half that, I consider that more than change from the couch cushions, and I can see a lot of good uses for which that money could be put. Could you tell me, in quantifiable terms, what public harm that you would see offsetting the public good of getting that money?
Well, first, I'll take the first, explanation of that. If you double the retail cost of alcoholic beverages, it's basically about $18 million. I think if you tripled it, maybe 36, and I'm talking about what you sell to your retail stores. To get up to $200 million is what you're charging in restaurants and other establishments, eating establishments where people get a drink at dinner and so forth. With the hospitality industry down 25% and restaurants struggling and going out of business, the idea of putting another tax on at this current time I don't think is a wise decision. Quite candidly, to raise that amount of money. Now, I'm not a person that drinks a whole lot. It's not going to affect me financially. But I think when you have a town in many areas that have numerous bars and restaurants that are struggling to stay open, and we're talking about helping small businesses, I don't think this is the time to put that tax on them.
I agree. You know, just Morton's closed the other day, 2 days ago. Morton's restaurant here right in Annapolis, the high-end restaurant closed. As a speaker, and others are struggling. The area I come from, Jasper's, has filed for bankruptcy. Some Outbacks are having trouble. Wawa closed in St. Mary's. You know, just the hospitality industry is suffering, as are other industries. We're very blessed in Maryland that we don't have a large manufacturing industry. Otherwise, our unemployment would be very, very high. Right now, it's close to 8%. Which is high, but it's much lower than any other state on the eastern seaboard. And right now, we don't need to put anybody else out of work. The governor indicated we're in the job creation business. These are very tough times, and where there are people in business right now, we need to try to keep them in business and hiring people so that people can provide for their families.
I mean, it sounds clear that what I'm hearing from the two of you and everyone else is there will be no revenue enhancements in this session coming through either one of your houses.
It's called taxes. I don't believe so. I mean, there's certainly going to be those proposed. But again, the Speaker and I have voted for tax increases in the past. We're going to continue to do so when it's right and when we get the votes. I proposed a gas tax increase just 2 years ago. I could get 18 votes in the Senate for it. I couldn't get any more than that.
For a gas
tax increase, which we have the second, as we heard today, we have the second longest commute time in the United States here. We have the most congested area outside of Los Angeles. And we haven't raised the gas tax since 1992, the last recessionary period. So somehow, somewhere, somebody's going to have to come up with the fortitude to move us forward in that area. And it's not going to happen this year, but it certainly has got to happen in the next cycle.
Let's go to our right again.
Hey, my name is Brandon Stevenson. I'm a ninth grade student.
Can you speak up a little bit?
My name is Brandon Stevenson. I'm a ninth grade student from Baltimore Freedom Academy. And my question is, what are you doing to support legislation that'll reduce pollution in the state of Maryland?
Well, first of all, the state of Maryland has not raised tuition.
Did you say tuition or pollution?
Pollution.
Oh, pollution. Look, a couple years ago, we passed the Clean Air Act to limit the amount of carbon and fossil fuels that could go into the air. We're in the process of being one of the states on the East Coast drawing what is known as the Reggie Coalition. It's been very beneficial to us. It's cut down the amount of carbon in the air. So we've taken a huge step in reducing pollution here in the state of Maryland.
We're also removing the nitrogen and phosphates from the rivers and the bay. We passed legislation requiring any new septic tanks to have the technology to make certain that happens, to avoid the runoffs into the bay. And so we're ahead of the federal government in terms of cap and trade. We're moving very rapidly in terms of protecting the environment. This is a very environmentally sensitive state. I mean, the largest estuary in the world, the Chesapeake Bay, is right here in Maryland. We have more miles of waterfront in Little Maryland than any state in the Union. We're very sensitive to that, and we're very protective.
So before we go to our left, and I hit the next speaker over here and make sure we get our SCL reporter in as well into this, since one of our partners here. You talk about the gas tax.
Right.
Somebody was in the other night was in a hedge, who used to have a major position in a hedge fund, runs a foundation. I said to him, how come nobody's investing in alternative energy? We're having this battle here in Maryland over the over the path of over the transmission lines going from Western Maryland to the Eastern Shore. That's going to be a huge battle coming up in the state this year over whether or not the people who are opposing it being built, people who are supporting it being built as kind of continuing coal of energy from coal as opposed to putting in alternative energy. And one of the things he said was, until you tax carbon, we will never invest in sustainable energy. I.e., in our state, we'll never build a transportation system outside of highways unless we do something like a gas tax, even begin the conversation. So how does that conversation start here in the state legislature in the state of Maryland?
I've kind of lost you here a second.
Taxing carbon.
Taxing carbon. In other words, what role do we play in that? In other words, he was asking questions about pollution.
Right.
And one of the things that it hit me was that the conversation I had with the folks from this hedge fund was that, no, we will never invest in alternative energy in America unless there's a reason to. The only reason would be if we tax carbon and force us to invest our money somewhere else.
But other people are investing. Solar energy, wind energy, we're moving forward in all.
Look,
we're looking fans out in the Atlantic Ocean. I mean, we're moving in all directions at the same time.
And 50% of the electric energy produced in the state
is coal.
Comes from Calvert Cliffs.
50%. From Maryland, right.
In Maryland.
Right.
And, you know, part of the issue is the debate over whether to put a new generator, a third generator at Calvert Cliffs. And what kind of benefit that's going to have to the state of Maryland. A bigger issue is our transmission lines, whether we have the transmission capacity to be able to handle the load that we have coming here, particularly in the Western Maryland corridor. But to approve those that go through multiple states, you need the Federal Energy Regulation Commission, known as FERC, to help you through that. So that individual might be making a statement, but in the state of Maryland, 50% of your energy is created right at Calvert Cliffs for nuclear energy.
Let me go back to the lines here. You're next.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for your time this morning. I'm Kalila Harris. I'm the executive director of the Baltimore Freedom Academy Foundation and a founder of Baltimore Freedom Academy Public Charter School. And I wanted to ask a question about young people's civil right to a high-quality public education in the state of Maryland. The governor has said that there has been drastic increases in public K-12 education over the past 4 years, which the numbers that I've viewed don't show at all a drastic increase. In some occasions, it shows the state's liability or contribution to local governments decreasing and placing a higher responsibility on local governments through adjustment of the GCEI. And I'm wondering from both of you how you can support ensuring that students achieve that civil right and possess that civil right of a high quality public education promised by the Constitution of Maryland by not reducing the state's contribution to local governments for education and not decreasing education funding for this budget cycle.
We provide education funding which is unparalleled anywhere else in the United States. In fact, in the last 4 years, the number of certified teachers in the state has gone from 67% to 85%. The test scores in Baltimore City have risen dramatically. The classroom sizes are down, all because of state dollars. These were very tough votes to make, and we're putting the resources on the front lines in education, and it goes up rapidly every year. In fact, we provide additional benefits to challenged areas such as Baltimore City and Prince George's County, where we need the most support.
Yeah, look, you know, in the last 6 years, the contribution to K-12 education has doubled. That's because the state passed the funding formula known as Thornton, and also the geographic index, which was fully funded last year. So the state's contribution has increased dramatically over the last decade, or even less than a decade, to the local subdivisions. And part of the problem with the local subdivisions is they can't keep up with their maintenance effort and are asking for waivers not to be able to fund where their liability is to continue to fund their K-12 education system. Last year, as you know, we were ranked number one in the country in K-12. That's because of the investment we made. And very few states allocate school construction money. And under Governor O'Malley's leadership, we will go to $1,250,000,000 worth of school construction, bringing the latest technology and upgrades to our schools. So I think the commitment to education is the major commitment that every legislator in Annapolis and the governor has made, and they've made the tough votes to be in this position. And we believe that it's been rewarded because we have the number one education system in the country, we have the highest percentage of college graduates in the country, we have a path from K through 12 right through a four-year degree, and it's helped us with our workforce and the fact that our economy, that our unemployment rate is 3 points below the national average. So I do think that we've made the commitment to K through 12 education.
Quick question here, we'll try to get all these four people on. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, Tom Bethards with the ACLU of Maryland. I understand there's an amendment pending to allow voter registration up until the election day. Do you support that amendment?
What is that?
There's an amendment being proposed to allow voter registration up till and through election day.
Allow registration for voting up until election day to increase voter turnout.
I support it, including same-day registration. An online registration, any way we can get people to the polls, and so that they can exercise their constitutional rights, I support it.
Yeah, I agree with Senator Miller, but you just to caution everyone, this is going to be the first year we're going to have early voting. And, you know, the format for early voting is going to take place in the state of Maryland. I do think that the vast majority of people in the General Assembly want to make sure that that works appropriately before they expand it. But I do support same-day registration. Whether it comes this year or in the future, I'm not sure.
To our left, I think it's a partner from WSCL, SDL.
Yes, Don Rush from Public Radio, Delmarva. I have a question regarding the budget in terms of the federal stimulus dollars. We know that the federal stimulus program is going to be running out within, I guess, the end of this year. Do you think, as state legislators, the federal government will be required or needs to have a second stimulus package to shore up the state of Maryland, as indeed we have benefited greatly from the first stimulus package? I mean, we've been able to maintain ourselves with a lot of federal dollars. Is a second one down the road? Do you think we need another one?
I think a second one's coming, but not so much for Maryland, but for California. Governor Schwarzenegger and others are really in desperate shapes. New York, Michigan, California, Florida. Our problems are very small compared to our sister states. So there's a big push by the nation's governors, Republican and Democrat, for additional stimulus. And if it comes, Maryland will get its fair share, and I think it'll be beneficial to us.
I totally agree. I think what Maryland needs is its fair share if that takes place. But there's many states that are in much more difficult positions than we are. And I don't see the federal government letting states like California fail. I mean, they're the 10th largest economy in the world. And I don't know how the federal government lets that happen. Look, none of these states created this recession. This recession was created by a lack of regulation at the Wall Street level. If you give $800 billion out to all the commodity traders and they can still get their $20 million bonuses, then I think we can stand up for teachers and policemen and firemen and doctors and things like that in all the states throughout the country. And I think, they deserve that.
So you don't think that Maryland will need money from a second stimulus that we could pass?
It depends on whether the economy improves in the next 18 months or not. If it doesn't improve in the next 18 months and we don't get a stimulus package, we're going to need to either look at a revenue increase or look at severely cutting government. I mean, there are the options.
Hi, good morning. My name is Hathaway Farabee. I'm with the Safe and Sound campaign in Baltimore, Maryland. My question is this. Regardless of how Maryland stacks up with other states in the country, regardless of that, there are too many people in Maryland in either prisons, juvenile confinement, or foster care. Too many folks spend their time in that, and I think we all agree per capita the cost for those services is almost indefensible. It's $33,000 for prison, $75,000 a year for a kid in juvenile confinement. Average length of stay for a kid in foster care is almost 4 years, and that's about $50,000. What we know, though, is those systems simply do not help people in general. In general, those systems tend to hurt folks, and then they come back into their communities and hurt their communities more. There are ways to move money out of those systems into alternatives and interventions that work better. I'm sure you know about the Maryland Opportunity Compact financing tool that right now is moving money out of those systems into interventions that work better and then use the savings to fund it. What else are you all thinking about to move money out of these systems into programs that work to give people a second chance to really get on to be productive citizens? There's about $1.5 billion in our sort of custodial care budgets in the state, and I would argue that there's really nothing to defend that kind of money invested for the poor outcomes that we get from it.
Gentlemen?
You obviously know more than I do on this subject, and I yield to your wisdom. All I can tell you is that, from my point of view, we do have too many people in the prison system. We need to have alternatives to our prison system. We need to have better outcomes in terms of our young people in foster care and a juvenile justice system that is broken. And every single administration that tries to fix it, whether at Hickey School or Sheltenham or what have you, it doesn't seem to work. But I'm anxious to sit down and talk to you and listen to your recommendations into how we as a state can do better for these young people.
I agree with Senator Miller, and also you probably know more about this than either he or I, but we have people in the General Assembly. Bobby Zirkin has been a champion of trying to find a better way for foster care and juvenile delivery of juvenile services that could be more cost-effective and also more beneficial to reentry into society. It comes in front of the budget every year. I would encourage you to meet with the subcommittee chairs of the budget in the House and Senate to look for alternative ways. In these tough budgetary times, we are looking for any alternative that we can save money, create efficiencies, and put out a better product.
I mean, that would be the question.
And Mark, if I could just follow up, if you'll just keep this in your mind, it is called the Maryland Opportunity Compact or the Maryland Reinvestment Contract, which is currently moving millions of dollars into more effective alternatives to these custodial care. My name's Hathaway Farabee. I will call your office just so you'll remember that as well, so I can get in and share with you how this is actually working and can save a considerable amount of money.
We also respond to our emails, honestly and truly. So you want to call
I'll try
us,
that
find
first.
Or email
I'll
us.
I'll try that first.
And we'll respond immediately.
Thank you for your time, Mr.
Thank you, Hathaway. I'm glad you got your question in. We have only a few minutes left, maybe 3 minutes here, so quick question.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Jenny Levin. I'm with the consumer group Maryland PIRG. Speaker Bush, I'd just like to thank you for your leadership on Delegate Hubbard's children's health legislation, specifically legislation that addresses the chemical bisphenol A found in baby bottles and Deca-BD, a flame retardant chemical, and for the last 2 years in a row, actually. And so my question is for President Miller. President Miller, we've seen considerable attention to the vulnerability of children to toxins in everyday products. But there hasn't been a lot of traction in the Senate on these bills. Bisphenol A, which is found in baby bottles, its restriction is supported by health groups such as the Breast Cancer Fund and the Maryland Nurses Association, and Deca-BDE is a flame retardant that's found in many household electronics. It's been supported by firefighter groups across the state, and I'd just like to know if we can expect the same kind of leadership that we've seen in other states here in Maryland addressing these chemicals.
I certainly hope so. We removed the lead from these from toys, and we passed the flame retardant cigarettes. And I'm not exactly sure what products you're talking about, but I assure you that Senator Catherine Hugh is a champion of this legislation. It goes to her committee, and we'll move it as quickly as we possibly can. Thank you.
And let me just say that in the last couple of questions, any other questions like that have come up, I encourage you to bring them to our attention. The Mark Steiner Show, and as this legislature moves on through the next few months, we can bring those specific issues up with our legislators and people on either side and get these conversations started in a larger community here in the state of Maryland. I want to thank both Senate President Miller and Speaker of the House Bush for taking the time once again, our 7th Annual Political Summit this year at St. John's College, for being with us. Thank you, gentlemen. Good to have you both with us. I want to thank once again our partners, the Baltimore Business Journal, for helping make this possible today, and our sponsors, Constellation Energy, Safe and Sound Campaign, the Maryland State Education Association, Veolia Transportation, the ACLU of Maryland, and Delmarva Public Radio on the Eastern Shore. And our volunteers coming today, Gay Pinder, Anthony McCarthy, we're here working on this today. We've been engineered today by Zachary Coleman from WEAA, Thomas Light here from St. John's College, one of IT support from Tim Houghton here at St. John's College as well. We're produced by Justin Levy, and we appreciate all of you getting up really early in the morning and coming out here to join us here at St. John's College, and for WEAA at 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. Thank you so much for joining us.